Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At 5,525 miles, the border between the U.S. and Canada is the longest and pretty much the friendliest in the world. Relations between the two nations are generally cheery, apart from the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, assorted dust-ups, a misunderstanding over the shooting of a pig, and that episode of West Wing, when a standoff between some hunters and Mounties escalated into an international incident.
Enough. This is stopping now. The problem is not a few rowdy outlaws from a bygone era blowing off testosterone. The problem is us. We're still the wild bunch. I mean, the higher it goes, the hotter the risk. I just threatened the Canadian ambassador.
Well, once again, truth may be stranger than fiction. It turns out that there have been a few scrapes and some bad blood between the rowdy U.S. and its polite northern neighbor. In fact, both the U.S. and Canada have plans on the books for full-scale war and seizure of each other's major cities. The American military plan was drawn up in the 1930s and is called War Plan Red, also the title of a slim and humorous little history by Kevin Lippert. The subtitle, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. Kevin Lippert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
I really did think this was a joke, like something from the plot of Infinite Jest. But it's funny that the history of conflicts between the U.S. and Canada exists and lies in the very foundation of both nations. They were originally one set of North American colonies. Why the split?
Well, after the Revolutionary War, and America felt that they had won the war, when they had the peace treaty negotiations in Paris, Benjamin Franklin had an idea which was, as long as we won the war, why don't you give us all of North America, including the Canadian provinces? The British at first agreed to that, but then backed off from that position and drew an imaginary line through the woods. These were days when the land just had not been explored, so they drew a line across the 47th and then later the 49th parallel and left it for later to actually locate the exact position of the border. So there was a lot of ambiguity about where the border was, and that led to numerous border tensions between the two countries.
Which really escalated in the War of 1812, when American troops thought that they would be welcomed as liberators as they invaded Quebec. They were not. What happened?
Well, there were, after the Treaty of Paris and the Revolutionary War, there were a lot of Americans who felt that somehow Canada was still owed to them. Among these, Henry Clay, who was an early Kentucky hothead, and President Madison at that time thought it would be easy, just a matter of marching, he said, an easy thing to march in and take over Canada. So during the Revolutionary War, the states had invaded Quebec because they assumed that the Canadians, like the Americans, would be eager to throw off the British. And they had that same assumption at least twice in the War of 1812, but some Canadians I spoke to in doing the research for the book feel that the War of 1812 was the war that cemented a Canadian sense of national identity. That was when foreigners invaded their territory, in this case the Americans, and that brought the British and the French closer together to repel the invasions.
Let's talk about some of these border skirmishes through the years. Wonderfully named Pork and Beans War of 1839. This is, as you put it, the only time in our history that an American state went to war with a foreign country. First, why the name?
Well, this was a war between lumberjacks in Maine and New Brunswick. And since pork and beans was the favorite food of lumberjacks, it became known as the Pork and Beans War. It's also known as the Roostock War, named after the Roostock County in Maine. Because of the fuzziness about the border between Maine and New Brunswick, lumberjacks from both countries or states and countries would routinely pass back and forth cutting down each other's trees. And there was one day when the Mainers had had enough. They invaded New Brunswick, and they were promptly captured by the Canadians and put in chains and taken off to prison. And this caused an uproar in Washington. Lots of men were mobilized. $10 million was authorized to declare war on Canada. And at that point, the British ambassador said, there's nothing worth fighting over here. So he gave a lot of territory to the United States to resolve that conflict without a shot.
Another escalation to international incident without a shot. the shooting of a pig in 1859. What happened here?
This is the same story, just on the other side of the country. One of the places that was also poorly defined was San Juan Island off the coast of Washington State and Vancouver. And both British and Americans occupied that territory to try and take it as, claim it as their own. There were some American farmer squatters, and on the other side of the island, the Hudson's Bay Company, which was, of course, the giant trading, fur trapping corporation, British corporation that owned pretty much all of Western Canada, and including some of the eastern provinces and bits and pieces of Minnesota. So they owned an astonishing 3,000 square miles, and including, they thought, the Vancouver Island. One day, a British pig was rooting in the garden of an American farmer who shot the pig, and this caused what I liken to a Falklands-like buildup. The British sent in a bunch of warships. We sent in more warships and more troops. And then finally, their order came from Britain to attack the Americans. The British admiral said, to have two great nations go to war over a pig is ridiculous. So he declined the order, and that war was also happily resolved without any loss of life.
Except for the
pig.
So
that one's called the Pig War, except for the pig.
But it sounds like a sort of history of, I don't know, incompetence, of almost playing Risk in some kind of way.
Yes.
What's going on there?
And nowhere was there more incompetence than in the War of 1812, where American soldiers launched a series of ill-fated raids into Canada, most of which were ended tragically for the Americans. And including maybe the most humorous was the after the Civil War, there was a group of Irish Americans who formed what they called the Fenian Brotherhood, and they also called themselves the Irish Republican Army, the first known use of the acronym IRA. Their idea was to invade Canada and exchange it as a hostage with Britain for the freedom of Ireland. So there were numerous Fenian raids across the border, one of which was semi-successful but only encouraged more unsuccessful raids.
Why on earth would the U.S. want to invade Canada? Well, turns out that on a number of occasions, that question has been, why not? Kevin Lippert is with us. He's author of War Plan Red, the United States' secret plan to invade Canada, and Canada's secret plan to invade the United States. Okay, so you were born in Leeds, England. Your mother is a naturalized Canadian citizen, and you live in the U.S. now. What is it that we just don't get here in the U.S. about Canada? First of all, thinking that you could trade Canada for Ireland as if you were playing some kind of game. What are we missing here? Why don't we get it?
I'm not sure we ever got past the idea that somehow Canada doesn't belong to us. And toward the end of the book, I talk about War Plan Rumsfeld, the sort of post-9/11 political reality of how America basically took control of the Canadian military. And I don't think it was ever debated. I think there was just an assumption that Canada is sometimes called America's hat. Canada sits right next door to us. Since World War II, they've been under our shield, our umbrella of nuclear deterrence. So I think there's just a sense that somehow Canada belongs to the States and we can more or less do with it as we like.
Well, relations are much better between the U.S. and Canada than certainly they were during the Pork and Beans War. But now we have this alliance, the NORAD alliance, centered in a bunker. What can you tell us about this secret alliance?
Canada made a superhuman contribution to World War II, and I think that was something I was never aware of, that 1 million out of 11 million Canadians served in World War II, and from thin air they created the world's fourth largest air force and the world's fifth largest navy. So they really stepped up to the plate and were a big factor in the victory in World War II, as a result of which, after the war, when we assumed our next war would be with Russia and not with Great Britain or Canada, Canada was invited to sit at the table with us at NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense, which was our nuclear shield to protect against a possible Soviet nuclear attack, in which Canada, probably not a target, but almost certainly collateral damage. And of the two commanding officers at NORAD, one is a Canadian and one is American. So they have equal footing at NORAD, at least. After 9/11, there were a couple of initiatives to expand that military collaboration, which resulted in an expansion of NORAD to include maritime, sea, and also land movements. So the post-9/11 version of NORAD. Mm-hmm. The United States and Canada are very much intertwined militarily.
Well, War Plan Rumsfeld was very different than the more covert war plans that were drawn up in the 1930s. This is the War Plan Red. It was declassified in 1974. But it turns out that Canada had drawn up its own plan 10 years earlier, almost like eerily mirroring each other. What were the basics of the plans?
Which they very politely called Defense Scheme Number 1. This was drawn up by Canadian
military.
Wait,
I just have to stop for 1 second. It's defense with a C in that very Canadian way.
Yes, of course.
But how passive aggressive is that to say it's a defense scheme when it's actually an offense scheme?
Well, it depends if you think Canadian politeness is passive aggressive. But it was a very passive aggressive scheme. The military officer who drew this up was a World War I vet, and he believed that a war between the United States and Britain was inevitable, and that the best defense would be a good offense. So he drew up a plan that would be a series of kind of blitzkrieg raids across the border. And he and a couple of his buddies had done some espionage in New England and upstate New York. They loaded into a Model T and took their Kodak Brownies and took a lot of pictures of bridges and roads that they were going to blow up as they retreated. His idea was, you raid the United States, you withdraw, and that buys time for Britain to sail to your rescue. And that was never obviously acted on. But it's interesting, as you say, that the two plans are really mirror images of one another. I guess we each identified each other's weak points, being, for example, Albany, Sault Ste. Marie, Bellingham, Washington, and we would either attack from there or be attacked at those points.
But the United States plan, $57 million was allocated from Congress to follow through on this plan. One of the strategies was to create military airfields and disguise them as civilian airports, for example. So how far did this get?
I think that's as far as it got in terms of actual readying for a war. They built these airfields. They had the largest military exercise in American history to that point was held at Fort Drum. They had 36,000 troops assemble on the Canadian border and have war games for a possible invasion.
I guess the question is, hasn't America on some level already invaded Canada, you know, with television and movies and pop music and sports that aren't hockey?
I think the conclusion of the book is that for all intents and purposes, on many levels, we already are one country and we've sort of slipped quietly into peace through an invasion of sports, entertainment, and a complete commingling of trade and economics. We are each other's largest trading partner. So we worry in the States a lot about China, but in fact, Canada is a much larger trading partner for us. The border is still friendly and quite porous, and there are millions of people pass every year back and forth between the United States and Canada in both directions. And one interesting statistic I learned in writing the book was that there are 250,000 Canadians who live and work in New York City, which makes it Canada's 15th largest city.
Well, now and again, everybody talks about moving to Canada, you know, whether for free health care or education or you get 18 months of maternity leave. Is that the
soul? Or to escape some political craziness.
Let that one go. It's been a while.
Now, well, we've got political craziness on the horizon that might prompt any of us to move up to Canada. But I've heard that comment from friends of mine on both ends of the political spectrum. If X is elected, I'm moving to Canada. But if we didn't have that safe haven, where would we go in order to maintain or find our sanity? And there are more concrete reasons besides finding some peace of mind. Canada, it turns out, has the world's second largest supply of oil and 20% of the world's fresh water. So they have some natural resources that we need and a lot of people think will be the subject of a future war. We've already had arguably 4 decades of war over oil, but a lot of people think fresh water will be the source of a next global conflict.
So we better cozy on up to Canada.
We better be nice.
Take some lessons from Canada. Well, Kevin Lippert, thank you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Kevin Lippert is the author of War Plan Red, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. It's a beautifully designed book, by the way. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.